Starship Rogan Show with Anna DeVlantis, yes, live from the Allstate Skyline Studio on 720 WGN.
Quite the show today.
Yep. It is. Mm-hmm. And we have many things that we'll talk about that are, obviously, we want to remember September 11th today.
Mm, absolutely.
It is distressing to me as you sort of scan the news. Every year, it seems like it becomes less and less relevant. And I remember as a kid, you know, you'd have people complaining about December 7th no longer being remembered in the way. Now, maybe mm-hmm. you get like a little sidebar story on a December 7th of you know, X number of years ago today, this happened. And it was such a consequential and monumental moment in American history. Mm-hmm. And I think that you know, this is even it's in the same ballpark of consequence in American history as
for sure
December 7th was.
But you still remember how you felt that day, don't you? Doesn't it always bring back those painful memories that you had the way you felt that day, even if you now have those feelings of insecurity and being scared or whatever it was that was filling your mind, it does come back, doesn't it, when you see this? I just think you now have people who are nearly voting age who weren't even alive when this happened. And you have, you know, a lot of people, young people, who just are learning about it through their parents, right, through watching these news reports.
Or Rosie O'Donnell, even worse.
You're learning about from it, the wrong people.
Or you're learning from the internet about it. And
they don't have that kind of internal, that feeling that evokes. It comes from inside of you again every time you see those Twin Towers.
I always think it's not going to be as effective. And then the day comes and I still get goosebumps and I still am brought to tears when I see the footage.
Me too.
And what I remember the most is not so much the fear, but the coming together.
I remember,
you know,
that after,
everybody.
But I just remember that feeling of not knowing what the heck was going on, and this feeling of I just felt insecure, like that, like it felt like.
But everyone was in the same boat, you know. Everyone didn't know what was going on. It felt like.
But then, you were in fourth grade, right?
Yeah, I was. Happened? Yeah, and I was nine. I was in fourth grade.
So your memory of it is: did your parents pick you up from school?
No, actually, my school didn't tell the kids, so we didn't know anything about it until the end of the day. And I went to a Catholic school, so we did a prayer every day after school, and we did a prayer for the plane crash, and all of us were like, "What plane crash?" You know, and they're like, "Your parents will tell you." We came out, and so many parents were crying and emotional at pickup. But we weren't aware of it during the day.
I think that's the difference, because I think there was that uncertainty during the day of what you just didn't know, right? I mean, you didn't know what was next, what was going to happen. Remember, even the fear that there might be a target in Chicago,
right,
that would be attacked. We didn't know.
Well, you had a couple of those crazy moments in the immediate minutes after, in Chicago, it was in the 8 o'clock hour, mm-hmm, right? It was just after 8 o'clock when it hit, and we started, you know, our phones started blowing up with those of us in our business, right? People were calling. I think everybody in every business, you know, was like, "Hey, did you see this?" But the first call I got was a small plane has hit the World Trade Center.
That's right.
And I was on the phone with my producer, and he was like, "This a small plane has hit." I go, "A small plane couldn't just hit the World Trade Center. That's just
I wasn't
if you're in a
it.
In a small plane." That's a big World Trade Center, you know?
And seemed odd, but that's the way it was treated, almost as if it were an accident.
Right,
the first time.
Then he's on the phone with me, and he goes, "Oh, my God, another plane just hit." And I just immediately, you know, went back home to get dressed for the day and went into the station, because it was going to be, you know. And
you knew then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
America was under attack. All those horrible feelings went through my head.
Watching when I was home, changing the tower, first tower came down. Mm-hmm. And I remember driving into downtown, and they evacuated downtown Chicago that day. That was, everybody got out. There are two times in my life, professional life, that has happened: when the river flooded, mm-hmm, and on September 11th, everybody got out. And I was driving in, and I was looking at the Sears Tower, which, you know, was rumored to be a target and we had no idea. Planes were coming out of the sky. We didn't know what, you know, if there were more planes on the way in these
first hours. You
didn't know
how many more and where.
Right. And I was looking at it and wondering to myself, is this the last time I'm going to see it?
Mm. I drove down the entire Eisenhower looking at the tower with my four-year-old in the car going to work on my day off.
Yeah. You brought your four-year-old to work?
I had to. Yeah. I dropped my other two off. As Viola said, there was school, thank goodness. Mm-hmm. I dropped them off. You know, I'll never forget, my boys were little, and they were, when they saw it happen on TV before I did, and they thought it was like, you know, a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They, you know, it was just awful. But I, same as you, I came in, I couldn't even cross the street once I got into the loop with my car, because there were the flood of people,
right,
all on their phones crying. I mean, that's really what I take away from that day, when I see just the, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people just fleeing from downtown Chicago to, right, go home.
It was the first sort of cell phone. This is before social media. And so it was the first cell phone event, you know, of where everybody had a cell, or the majority of people had a cell, and they weren't really texting each other, but calling each other.
They weren't really smartphones then. I mean, yeah, it was more like, I mean,
everyone was on their phone talking. Everyone, yeah, had a phone up to their ear.
Right.
Yeah. It was, you know, you just horribly unsettling. I remember I was on Lakeshore Drive heading to Rogers Park, because I worked nights at NBC then, and just like you, Roe, the first plane hit, and we were all kind of checking in with our assignment desks and saying, yeah, you know, the accident, you know, just seems like something happened weird. And then the second plane is when I think everyone...
See, there's so much confusion. Recognized. Our principal came on the intercom and said the World Trade Centers have been bombed. Nobody really knew. And then by the time I got the second period, I go to art class, and the teacher's in there crying, and everyone's huddled around watching TV, and you're like, oh my God. Then it sort of sits in.
Yeah.
And then I got to my third class, and it was my old school history teacher, and he was angry. So I had, my first period was a stunt. My teacher had this, his face went blank when our principal came on the intercom. The second class, everybody's crying. By the third class, teachers were angry. So it's kind of the, yeah, stages how everybody,
sure,
felt.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, trying, mm-hmm, to figure out what it was, and you know, who would be responsible for that. And it, you know, when the first plane hit, because it was, I think, 6, 7, 8 minutes. It eludes me now, the difference in time between the first and second plane hitting.
Mm-hmm.
The first plane hit at 8:46 New York time.
Right, and then the second one at...
At 9:42. Actually, no.
No. It was within 15 minutes or something.
9:03.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, so in that period of time, again, once people realized it wasn't a small plane but a bigger plane, because once it went in, the hole was hard to see on the first... On the, you know, because the fire was just starting in there. There was smoke coming out, but you didn't see how big it was, and it sort of had pierced that, you know, the shell of the building, essentially, which is one of the reasons that the buildings collapsed, and because it was the way that they were built. It would, you know, people are like, well, maybe a pilot just lost his way. And then when the second one goes in and we realize something bad had happened, and then it was fairly quickly thereafter, it was within a couple of hours. I think maybe one, not both, had fallen at the time where they realized that this was Al-Qaeda and an international terror event. And that's when people got, you know, they're like, oh, what is this all about? All right. Ben Bradley's going to join us here in just a moment. But Vicki, I want to just get Vicki on quickly on WGN, because she's going to make a point about something. Go ahead, Vicki.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. When people go to New York, to Ground Zero, it's a very busy place. When they go to Washington, D.C., it's a very busy place. But if you've never been to Shanksville, and we were there 4 years ago before the big tower and all of this, talk about a place of quiet and reverence, and you see this long white wall where the name of all 40 people are on it, and then there's this fence that you can't go to, and you look through the fence and you see this big boulder, which is where the plane stopped as it was hitting the ground, and it literally shoved the boulder up through the ground, and that was the point where they stopped.
Wow.
And you have to kind of weave your way back in order to get there. And it's a place that we actually found it by accident. I happened to see it, and I told my husband, I said, oh my gosh, we have to go there.
Yeah.
And it's a place to make it a point to go there.
Thank you.
Because it's very unlike New York or Washington.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You don't think of it as
much. You're
welcome. Right.
Yeah.
All right, let's check in with Judy right now. What's coming up at the bottom of the hour?
It will be devastating. The latest on Hurricane Florence.
Tonight, the fight for the Central Division is at Wrigley. Bring it, Milwaukee Cubs Brewers, tonight at 7 on WGN-TV.
Bert Concho with Anna DeVlantis, live from the Allstate Skyline Studios. Here is Ben Bradley, live from the WGN-TV CLTV studios right now on West Bradley Place in Chicago. And hold on one second, Benjamin. I will get. I'm going to get
there?
To you right this
yes,
second because
is.
Benjamin, it's very important that we talk. And mm-hmm. here you are. There you go, sir.
Thank you very much for allowing me to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate
then.
It.
All right.
I'd like to propose a rule.
Yeah.
Okay.
On September 11th, please don't post on social media unless you've thought about it. And then, even after that, think again, reread, and decide whether it's a good idea. That goes for everybody from the president on down to reporters, to politicians, and your average Joe.
And don't politicize it. How about that? Could that
exactly.
be another rule? Because
exactly.
I saw your post, and I thought, no way. Tell us about it.
So a Northwest suburban state representative who is newly appointed, this is Helene Walsh, wife of former Congressman Joe Walsh, just shared a post on her personal Facebook page, which is accessible to anybody, talking about leftists, progressives. She mentions our former eloquent president. And in a tribute to 9/11, titled Never Forget, she mentions the Islamic terrorists who attacked the USA. On September 11th, 2001, then this post goes on to say, and this was a post, again, she shared, she did not write, "We have seen evil fly planes into buildings full of people going about their lives, but we must be vigilant and fight off those who are intent on bringing down our government and our duly elected officials in far more insidious ways." So this post goes on to talk about politicians on the left and elected officials seeming to suggest they're more intent on bringing down the government than people who flew airplanes full of people into skyscrapers and a field mm-hmm. in Pennsylvania. She has, about 10 minutes after we called her office to inquire about the post, it was deleted.
What I have always wondered is who would marry Joe Walsh, and I just figured it out. So that's how that all worked out.
Well, and this isn't
a good-looking man, though.
This isn't the first controversial social media post that she has either made or shared. And in fact, it came up when the Republican committee up in Lake County was naming her to fill this seat recently, because I know folks have a short memory, but it was just a few weeks ago when the guy who held the seat before Ms. Walsh was booted because he allegedly sent naked pictures of an ex-girlfriend to men.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is the person who mm-hmm. replaced her.
Mm-hmm.
Him.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well,
you know,
the Illinois Republican Party, though, is the the management of the Illinois Republican Party now. It's not Bruce Rauner. It's some pretty Trump-centric conservatives, right?
Well, and the Republicans are no different from the Democrats, right? There are different factions in each party, and there are factions of the Democratic Party that cringe, you know, every time a candidate who's gaining momentum talks about socialism or abolishing ICE.
Right.
You know, there are sides in each of these parties, and a core group of people someplace in the middle who says, hey, let's not talk about the stuff on the extremes of the parties. Let's talk about what's in the middle holding the tent up.
Yeah, well, the days of Kirk Dillard are kind of over, right? And it's more of it's talk radio Republicanism is what you see in Illinois now, literally and figuratively.
Well, and it's candidates who can get a lot of attention based on generating a lot of outrage and support on social media. And you only get that when you say extreme things, either way.
Right.
And so, we're kind of picking on this Northwest suburban state representative, but the reality is, especially on a day like September 11th, whether you're the president, tweeting early in the morning, about no collusion and all sorts of things unrelated to the solemnness of this day, it's just jarring, I think, for everybody, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who goes on social media, and let me tell you, social media is jarring to begin with.
Oh. Yeah, yeah.
But that's
how
what
about
it's
it?
Intended to be, right?
Yeah.
Well, we're
going
to tell a story coming up in just a few minutes of one guy who on that day, 17 years ago, decided he wanted to go do something about this. And he was a volunteer fireman, an auxiliary fireman. He went to, you know, got in his car and just drove east. And what his story was and the sacrifices he made as a result of that. And it's going to make you proud to be a Chicagoan.
Those are the stories that we should like and share on social media on a day like today. Aaron Ivory's got one of them for you coming up at 4 o'clock. It's actually a group of people that we followed for several years setting up a lemonade stand to raise money for charities. They do it on 9/11. And we've followed them over the years. And it's amazing how this has grown over the years. So we'll update that story as well as have a look at 9/11 remembrances from all over the country.
All right. Thank you, Ben.
Yep. Thanks, Ben.
Appreciate it. We'll check in with Judy Pilak with WGN News. Coming your way into. Rob Collins Show with Anna DeVlantis. Right here on 720 WGN and CLTV. And this is September 11th, 2018. 17 years ago today. Anybody who lived through it remembers it.
Yeah.
And Bart McCartan is a Chicago businessman and a philanthropist. And also, I should mention that he's the chairman of the corporate board of directors of the Boys and Girls Club of Chicago. And he's certainly a guy who likes to give back. And Bart, you and I have known each other for a while. And your story of September 11th is one that I often tell other people, and I thought this would be a good opportunity for us to talk a little bit about it, because you were a volunteer firefighter, right?
Correct. Yes, I was a volunteer and part-time out in just in the near suburbs of Chicago. That is correct.
All right. And that's not, and you've been in business, right? And, you know, went to college and grad school and been in business, but this, you just sort of had this idea, this desire, this first responder kind of desire to also do that if people were in need. And so then the next, you know, you're watching, take me through the morning of September 11th for you.
Well, in 9/11, 17 years ago now, we had our family construction businesses in Chicago, in Industrial Union Construction, and we were sitting in a staff meeting and had a TV on in the background in the conference room. And as everything began to unfold, you know, like the rest of the country, I think just the absolute surreal and unreal began to kind of peel apart on live television as to what was starting to take place in both New York and then ultimately in D.C. and in Pennsylvania. And shortly thereafter that, within hours of the second tower coming down, a number of first responders, primarily from the city, that both were dear friends and family, came together and started to contact each other that for sure there was going to be a group that was going to organize and wanted to go to New York and who wanted to try to go and be a part of that. And collectively we grouped up and got into a caravan, and in the coming days in the first several days of the response ended up in New York and in the midst of the one and two World Trade Centers in the middle of the site.
Explain what that was like when you first got there.
You know, again, that word surreal, I think, rings out and is especially prevalent as it relates to the conditions that not only first responders, but that the countless volunteers that came from all over the country experienced when they got there. To walk into a situation where both one and two World Trade Centers were down, that skeletal piece of two World Trade Center was still up in the air that everyone saw iconically on the news over and over. But then you had one financial plaza was literally blown out, all the glass and the dust. You had seven World Trade Center was on fire and had ultimately just collapsed. Three World Trade Center, the Vista Hotel collapsed, was on fire. You had countless buildings around it with heavy destruction. And it was certainly surreal to see that in the middle of Midtown Manhattan in the financial district, and to just see not only the level of devastation, but the eerie silence that had taken over the city.
The people, yeah. Bart, I talked to, and I wonder about your experience with this. Firefighters I know who came from this area went out that way, so they'll never forget the dust, they'll never forget the smell, and they remember that whenever someone was found, a body was found, that people would stop and either say a prayer, salute, or do something to mark that moment. It was such an emotional thing to be involved with.
Yeah, that's very true. I think, to say the least, to say that this was an emotional roller coaster when you got there, and throughout the entire process, especially for that first week, it was exactly that. The smell was horrific, from a combination of burning, it was a burning oily jet fuel type smell, along with other just really pungent, tough smells, alongside of the fact that, you know, you were trying to, I guess the toughest part that you would go up against emotionally was the fact that you got there because you wanted to try to help in any way possible, mm-hmm. specifically and especially. I mean, whether that meant trying to help people off the site, on the site, we were fortunate enough to get into the site. And the expectation was is that you wanted to try to find people, and you didn't. But what would happen was is that there would be a stopping of the entire ground operations to try to hear if people were still alive or trapped, and you would get false readings many times. People would work furiously, I mean furiously and emotionally, to try to get to different areas, to try to respond to where people were at, to no avail. And then what you would find is remains, and you would do your very best to treat that with the respect and dignity that you could, so that that could be returned to family members. And New York walked their own out, whether it was police or fire. There was a system that they came up with that, as they went throughout those days, that as they recovered, especially emergency workers and first responders, that was very reverent and done with the greatest sense of sincerity to respect.
Yeah. I was there 2 weeks after, and I will never forget the smell. Is, to me, you'll never smell it again, because there was also, you know, molten steel, right?
That's
there was
right.
There was molten steel. It was as you pointed out. I mean, there was a very biological smell there as well, and the ground was hot. I mean,
that's
literally
right.
I think, and you talked to like Bart and the other first responders who were there, and you know, they talk about even though they have equipment that keeps their boots from melting, mm-hmm. it was incredibly hot in that site, because it literally was a smoldering sort of center fire that was going on underneath there for weeks.
That's exactly right, Ro. And because of all the burning, you know, you had burning materials underneath, everything was highly compacted. You had, you know, multiple levels and layers underground that, you know, had taken on both collapse, as well as there were pockets of air and forced air from the subway tunnels that then was, you know, pushed
feeding
up against
the fire, right?
Burning fuel and steel. And you would, you know, in certain areas of the pile that you'd be working in, that, you know, and again, that evolved on a daily basis as different areas opened up, but you'd burn you could burn up your boots. You had to be very cautious with where you went. The holes would open up, areas would open up. It was extremely dangerous. And by the way, while that's all going on, you know, another major part of the emotionality of all this was the fact that the unthinkable had just happened to this in this country. So at that time, rumors were running as rampant as to what was going to happen next at the exact same time it paralleled the rescue efforts. So yeah. There were concerns throughout that there could have been explosives buried in vehicles in the underground parking decks in the way that it was bombed in 93. There were concerns about what they called the slurry wall, or the bathtub was what they referred to it in slang there, is against the Hudson River was going to breach, and, you know, water was going to flood into many of the voids that rescue workers were in and trying to respond through. So it was quite the up and down of emotions, and really was something that I will never, ever, ever forget.
So let's talk about you spent more than a week there, right, as a first responder, and then
yes.
came out. And talk a little bit about what that felt like coming out. It's such a weird feeling in New York in those weeks, and months really afterwards, and you're looking at that space and you remember what that space was, right, in your mind's eye, or people who lived there for sure, and then it's gone. And then you go a couple blocks north. Well, I mean, basically, once you got about 10 blocks north of the site, it turned back into New York. And it was, and New York was active and moving, and with the exception of the West Side Highway, it was all open. And to me, it was such there's a surreal nature of a real thing going on, such death and destruction in this area, and then out to real humans trying to live their lives. So you come back to Chicago, which is, you know, completely, thank God, was completely intact. And what was that like as you were sort of reemerging into friends and family?
Well, to say the least, I mean, coming back, you know, going out there, you're full of adrenaline, you're full of hope, you're full of focus, you're full of, you know, we want to try to do whatever we can to help. And then you get there and you experience the reality of the situation, and you experience the reality of a lot of the devastation that take place. And as you're coming back, you know, what seems to be a 6-7 hour car ride on the way out turns, feels like 3 days driving home. And you come back and you try to then process and take in the experiences emotionally, physically. You came back exhausted. Virtually everybody came back with some form of a cough from all the dust and debris, and really starting to process what happened. And it was very tough. It's sad. There's a lot of post-stress issues that go on there. That come from that in terms of being able to talk through what you experienced and how you experienced it. But I will tell you that at the exact same time that was a major part of the experience, you know, initially, I don't want to in any way forget to say or to speak to the fact that to your point, Ro, while you're in New York, you know, New York is still alive and moving and vibrant city as it is. And the absolute thing that did take place there throughout the entire rescue effort, throughout the entire recovery effort, the way home and when we got home was just an overwhelming sense of positive and good human spirit, and how Americans came together and how all people came together, regardless of political aspirations or parties or what anybody's personal agendas were. People came together in a way that I have never seen in my 46 years of life on this earth, that came together to support one another and to do the right thing. And sometimes that meant while we were there, people were coming out and passing out sandwiches or toothbrushes and toothpaste, or people were giving medical services or massage services or anything you could have possibly imagined. When that word surreal doesn't do it justice. All of those things really and just truly created an overwhelming sense of good over evil, because make no mistake, this was a very, very evil thing that took place in this country. And that sense of good is what I think gave at least myself and the guys that went there and volunteered to try to help. It was the major factor, I think, that gave us the opportunity to keep going. Mm-hmm. And it's what gave us the opportunity to feel good when we got home, as it related to knowing that we tried to do something. And you know, that sense of spirit and help is something that just really, I think, showed the world what this country's all about and what 9/11 was all about. Because, but you know, make no mistake, the true heroes of 9/11, you know, were the first and foremost, the initial first responders, the 343 firefighters and 60 police officers that gave their lives, who walked into something that many of them, especially in the second wave, they knew what they were walking into. They knew full on that they were walking into something they weren't going to walk out of, and they still went in there. And then you take that and you look at all the civilians, the thousands of civilians who perished in this, and you take all of them and their families, the first responders and their families. You had hundreds upon hundreds of civilians who helped inside those towers and around those towers to help get people out. You know, those folks, absolutely, they executed one of the largest ground rescues in the history of this country, in the history of the world, probably. They saved tens upon tens of thousands. And the fact that they died for doing that and for overcoming a really bad thing that happened here I think it was that sense of good over evil and that sense of what people tried to do to come from every corner of this country to help in every single way possible that really made the turn of the tide. At least I know it did for me. It's something I will never forget and something that's had a huge impact on my life.
Bart, thank you very much for sharing the story. I appreciate it. Bart McCartan, who is the principal and managing partner of NIS, but is also the corporate, the chairman of the board of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Chicago. An American hero, a Chicago hero. Bart, thanks very much for being with us, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Bart.
Not at all. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. All right.
Good story.
Yeah, this guy wears a suit by day, and, you know, he's a volunteer firefighter. And that's what he did. And he came back. You know, he doesn't really like to talk about it a lot, but there was a lot of the guys he came back with had a lot of medical problems and others as a result of just going and doing the right thing. So
I can only imagine.
Yeah. All right. Judy, what's coming up at the top of the hour?
The hurricane's already hit Wall Street.
Man of the hour right now is Tom Skilling.
He
and
is.
And he's brought to us by PermaSeal Basement Systems.
Hello, guys.
And hey, I am looking. There's nobody, you know, Rick DeMaio, who I love and adore, was a television meteorologist here for many years. Now he's a college professor,
yes,
teaching young kids what this is all about. And he was, and to me, this is what you're the godfather of all weather forecasters. But he was an aviation meteorologist for United Airlines.
He was,
and I was always really impressed by that because that's like what a cool job that would be, right?
Yeah,
to figure out routings and things like that. But he said to me today, he was like, "You are so lucky that you have Tom Skilling to be able to explain this stuff to you." So even the greats, you're the GOAT. You're the GOAT,
that's
Tom
very
Skilling.
Nice. Mm-hmm. I tell you, you know, I will never forget Rick recounting, what was that plane that went into Sioux Falls, South Dakota with no hydraulics? Remember that?
Oh, that was United Airlines.
Yeah,
aircraft, right?
And he was out at corporate headquarters, which at the time was out in Elk Grove
Sioux
Village,
Sioux City, yes, Iowa. Yeah.
And I remember Rick recounting how everybody quietly gathered on the periphery of the central control facility, listening to the communications between that plane and and ground control. And you know, you can imagine what a horrifying situation that was. But Rick is very sharp. He's quite a meteorologist, and he knows his meteorology. That's quite a compliment.
Yes,
thank you.
Yes, he did say that. All right. Well, so let's talk about this because first of all, am I wrong or right about this that we're looking at some sort of new technology to be able to assess this? I'm seeing images surrounding this thing that I have not really seen before.
Well, you know, we have that new GO-16 satellite, which is amazing. First of all, it sends back pictures every 30 seconds if you want it to. And also, it has four times the resolution or clarity of any of the images that we got before in the visible and the infrared. So, and it's got a bunch of sensors on it. It can detect lightning. But when you play a movie of 30-second images, they call that a super rapid scan movie. It's amazing. You can see the tops of the clouds boiling.
Yeah.
And the clarity. You see the little micro vortices rotating around the eye of the storm within it. You can get that close.
That's what I'm talking. That's because I've just noticed that the clarity, we're seeing
stunning.
Here is stunning. And you also get a sense. To me, these moments are so other earthly, where you stop and you think, God, we are so insignificant in this whole process.
It's
when
so
you
true.
See this.
Well, you know what? You're so right, Ro. This storm is right up there. I mean, this is not your run of the mill garden variety hurricane. None of them are. But this thing, think about it. There have only been three Category 4 storms that have gone into the United States since 1851 over the entire hurricane record from South Carolina. North. This one may be the most northerly landfalling storm of its kind. It's intensified at a rate that's just unbelievable, and it's going into an area that is very susceptible to storm surges. The continental shelf there goes out 50 miles, and the water over it is relatively shallow. It's about 125 feet or less. So what happens
is
these
thousands of feet deep on that shelf.
Beyond it, yes.
Yeah.
And if you, as this storm comes in, its winds pile up the water and the height of the storm surge grows tremendously. The last two big storms that are in the league with this one that hit with tides at high tide as it came ashore were Hazel back in 1954 and Hugo, that few of us will forget. Mm-hmm. That one in just north of Charleston. And those storms produced 18 to 20 foot storm surges. And to put that in perspective, that would be like raising the level of Lake Michigan 18 to 20 feet, then putting 20 to 25 foot waves on top of it. And those waves offshore, by the way, could be up to 50 feet if you were out in a, you know, one of these freighters or something out there.
Right.
So this thing will literally,
as that thing would come across, it's
it'll submerge these barrier islands, you know,
right.
Many of which are there because of past hurricanes. You know, they were created by the storms. Mm-hmm. And what nature giveth, nature can taketh away, you know. So
it's a beautiful part of the world,
it
too.
Is.
You know,
it is. So many Midwesterners, you know, go there.
Oh, and gorgeous beaches and all. Yeah.
Kiowa really is. Island is right. Kiowa is on places. One of the barrier islands. Kiowa is a barrier island. And it's got, you know, that's a billion-dollar real estate resort, complex there.
Yeah.
That is sitting right. That's ground zero.
Gee. Yeah, I know. As you look at the models, Tom, yesterday you were saying the U.S. models are doing very well,
yeah,
against the Europeans. But are they all showing this potential for intensifying it from this point forward?
They're all in line on this thing,
yeah,
pretty much. This thing is going into North Carolina now. What happens after that is almost as scary as the storm itself, because the thing's going to slow down. And by the way, there's been a recent report out that one of the features of climate change is that these tropical cyclones slow down in their movement, and therefore these prolific rains. There is no rain producing system like a tropical cyclone, a hurricane, or a tropical storm. And we saw it last year with Harvey down in Houston. This thing's going to come ashore and then slow down. It may even stall. And that means its rains are going to park over that area, and it's just going to rain and rain and rain on the Carolinas, Virginia, areas like that. So the flooding with this thing is going to be catastrophic, and some of the rain totals will be up there in the 20-30 inch range, if not higher in spots. So it's this is something, you know, it's interesting. The European Center's wave height model runs a rogue wave component, and I was noticing that they indicate that there could be some rogue waves that reach 90 feet offshore in, you know, the open waters.
Wow.
So
10 stories.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, that is amazing. If you go on YouTube, you can go on there and get just type in, ocean liners and big waves. And they've got a sequence there of what it's like to be bobbing around in 40 to 50 foot waves. It's stunning to see that. It's really scary. But what happens on shore is going to be a mess.
So now they always say for the big ships, they take them out into the ocean,
right?
To sustain these, you know, because they're going to just get battered against.
I worked in Jacksonville, and they had the Mayport Naval Station down there, and that's what they did. And of course, we've got a huge number of naval and military facilities
right up and down that coast.
That's,
yeah,
huge.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you're near the Norfolk Naval Station and all the rest, and they send these ships out, right, to sea, and they try to position them so they can get them back in again to help if they need to.
Yeah, the Atlantic Fleet is based in Norfolk, so
yeah,
they're going to have to get them out, and they move them. They start to move them now, and they get them
try
to get them up and away, or down and away from the storm, so that, you know, they're. But you know, that changes that. That's an expensive process. They've got to get those crews. You know, so those ships don't just sail themselves, right?
No, and not only that, Ro, you know, the waves propagate hundreds of miles from these storms. So they're still going to be in, huge seas and all. In fact, the seas are already starting to close in on that area. And by the time...
And the crews, I would imagine the cruise ships, too, totally navigate around. Because it is surprising. We always think about Florida as a place where cruise ships come out of.
Yeah.
But there are other places. They're in the Carolinas and in New York City. There are cruise ships that, you know, go down to the Caribbean and then come back. So there is traffic that is moving in this area that's, you know, north south throughout these
sure
lanes.
Oh, it's a busy strip of marine you wouldn't call it real estate, but water. Yeah, absolutely. To put the rarity of a storm of this intensity in some kind of historic context, there have been 24 Category 4 storm landfalls. This one may, just as it reaches the land, start experiencing some shearings. And so the thinking is it might go onshore in its last hours as a Cat 3. But you know, it's an abstract difference, really, in some respects, or an academic, change. Cat 3 is a devastating storm. But there have been 24 Cat 4 landfalls in the United States since 1841. So that's an average of one Cat 4 every 7 years. These don't happen every day.
Right. And they've got the mandatory evacuations along the shore areas of South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia. But you wonder if they're going to expand that even further because of what you're saying there, Tom, that there's going to be devastation that goes quite a bit inland and difficulty getting out. They've reversed the direction of the highways
right.
in South Carolina, North Carolina to try to encourage people to get out, but you always have those people who are just, you know, hey, I'm far enough away from the coast. I'll be okay.
So true. And Anna, the thing to keep in mind is, you know, winds rotate around a hurricane and any low pressure counterclockwise. So if you're south of the point of landfall, the winds are blowing offshore, which is what happened in Hugo, and that's one of the things that saved Charleston and Hilton Head, devastation that otherwise would have occurred. But if you go north of the point of landfall, which right now looks like it's going to occur somewhere around Wilmington or maybe just a tad north of that, so that would put Wilmington and areas north, Cape Hatteras and that whole area up there at extreme risk along the coast, because the winds are blowing up against the shoreline and they pile the waves and the water up there, and you get the biggest storm surges right there.
Okay.
So if you're south of it, you'll have some waves and you'll have some big rains, but you don't have the coastal damage. But the inland rain event on this is going to be probably as catastrophic, if not more so, than what goes along the coast.
Right. I mean, the drama of this, obviously, is these gigantic waves if they do hit, but that's what always gets people.
Yep.
In hurricanes.
The flooding.
It's the flooding.
Yep.
It is. And they don't leave. And then you've got these yahoos that are sitting there going, well, I'm going to stay.
Yeah, stay. You know, I know.
That's what I like to do.
Well, you know what they tell them in these hurricane zones is put your social security number on you because when your body is located.
Yeah.
Take your permanent marker and write it on your arm.
Yeah.
Remember that Texas mayor said that last year, his town, that Rockport was in the eye of Harvey. And that's what he said. He said, okay, it's your choice.
Yeah.
But this is what you need to do.
Yeah. Save us the having to identify your body afterwards.
It's insanity. All right. Tom, thank you very much. But nice weather here as a result of this.
Yeah.
Makes it feel
the
better.
The irony is the atmospheric setup keeps high pressure over us. So we're in great shape.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Guys. We'll talk more about this tomorrow.
We will indeed.
Judy, what's coming up at the bottom of the hour?
A fire in a Lakeshore Drive high rise.
Violetta? A couple things on the sports desk that we have to share with you here.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, now the White Sox, is Jose Abreu's story. The White Sox said that he needed abdominal surgery.
That's right. But the New York Post had it identified more specifically.
Yeah.
The New York Post?
The New York,
New York
been
Post.
Been out for 2 weeks. Testicular torsion.
Strangled testicle.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yep.
Oh, God. What?
Yeah, that's they potentially lose the testicle.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but they saved it, and he's back.
He says he's very thankful to all the people, the doctors, and everyone in the hospital who helped him.
I just want to say, like a kidney, you can live on one testicle if you have to.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, but two's always better.
Two is always better, but you can. It's possible to live on one.
Sounds like a
you
terrible
don't need
injury.
A transplant.
Transplant.
What?
Oh,
or,
God.
You know, like a nudicle or whatever those things, you know, they're getting for dogs. You know, where they, because dogs
a
feel bad about themselves.
I've never heard of this.
Really? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
A what?
Yes. When, you know, many dogs, obviously, most
they go on the chopping
domesticated
block.
Dogs, right, get neutered. And
okay.
When they get neutered, that some people don't like the way it looks.
They want it back?
They would rather have
some
those things hanging?
Or some dogs?
Well, I happen to think it's the dog that does, you know, because the dog's like, what the hell does that?
Where'd that go?
I mean, I don't know how the dog would ever trust you again after that. Like, you'd go to that's why all the male dogs at the, when you take them to the vet, they're shaking. They're like, what are they going to take now?
This is why you should get a shelter dog. It's already done, so then they don't blame you.
They don't remember it. Yeah, but they don't want to go to the vet because I remember what happened last time.
But I do remember
the you can get for your dogs. You can get
like a clip on.
Yeah. Well, they put them in. They keep that assembly down there, and then they put these. Basically, I think they're like ping pong balls or something in there, and then they walk around. They still can show off to the ladies.
Wait,
oh,
what?
It's like a surgery. It's not just
they
like
add them.
Yeah, no, they add them.
You totally are making this.
I am totally not. This
Why
is not fake news.
Do that?
Look it up. Nudicle.
Nudicle?
Look up the word nudicle.
I thought you made up the
word. N-U-T-I, cull.
N-U-T.
N-E-U. Nudicle. Like neuter. Like neuter.
Oh, like that.
I found it.
Yeah, the nudicle.
Nudicles are prosthetic testicular implants for neuter dogs and other domestic animals.
Right.
But it's all about optics and
aesthetics. Yes, it's aesthetics.
They kind of look like earrings.
Yeah.
Or actually, maybe these are nudicle earrings. Never mind.
That these are nudicles.
Oh.
Yeah. How about that? So your doctor, not only is mom getting Botox, but the dog's getting new nudicles.
There's a picture of Bruiser and after.
Yeah. See? Because Bruiser's got to have that.
Bruiser looks much happier.
Yeah, if your name's Bruiser, you can't be walking around without it.
Not really. No. Does Bruiser need it, or does Bruiser's daddy need it?
I mean, look at Bruiser's face. He needed them.
Yeah. I think Bruiser feels much better about that.
He's like, yeah, I got some.
Yeah. Can you get a tummy tuck for your dog, too? And, like, butt implants?
Yeah, I'm certain all of that's possible.
I mean, considering all the money people blow on their pet dogs, yeah, I'm sure you can probably get that
done. Plus, it's also more for the dog to play with. Let's face it. I mean, the dog, dogs, the before and after on that with the dog does get a little upset, like, afterwards. After the lampshade comes off, and then they go down there, and they're like, hey!
Well, Bruiser doesn't have a tail. It's a bulldog, so what else is he going to chase?
Right.
You know.
And then, they spend a lot of time in the bathing situation down there.
Yeah, that's like a hobby for them.
Yeah.
Well, they only do it because it's dirty. If you don't have them, you don't have to.
That's right. Let me tell you, I got a dog, and he doesn't have any, and it's a lot cleaner and nicer.
Deep down, he misses them.
He does not.
Oh, yeah, no, he does. Yeah. No, he
and
does.
And he's still quite ferocious.
Well, that's why.
Well, I'd say you got to get it early because once the testosterone releases, it doesn't do anything. The dog's still going to be angry.
Yeah, that is true.
Got to get it done young.
And a chaser and a pillow humper.
Totally overrated.
You know, you got to make sure.
Is he a humper, Judy?
No, not yet.
Yes.
He's still young.
Does he take the packs off the couch and then put them down and arrange them?
No.
And then, like, walk away, then walk toward them, like, hey, I'm walking away from you. No, I'm not.
What's up?
Now we're doing it.
What's up, pillows?
Yeah.
Want to give me the ride of your life?
That might be when I get rid of him.
Nudicle. I still can't believe this is a thing.
Take this pillow
totally
to town.
I thought he made that word up.
I totally think he made it up.
Like, didn't it like a row word?
Yeah, guys, right. Like, it's a nudicle. So.
The little pillow you want to have dinner afterwards or what?
Bruiser, I see you had some work done down there. Yeah, these are my nudicles. No big deal.
Why is your dog smoking a cigarette?
Why is the pillow on fire? There's a lot of questions. A lot of questions to be asked here.
Bruiser, you're quitting smoking tomorrow.
Why you'd need the nudicle surgery is question number one.
Makes the dog feel better about itself. The dog doesn't want to go to the dog park.
Oh, my God. Kim Kardashian nudicled her dog.
Of course she did.
She's on nudicles.com as one of the featured stories.
Mm-hmm. It's all about the appearance. Well, I'm going to tell you something right now. You got a pit bull. You definitely want to get the nudicles for the pit bull because that completes the look.
So would you get the nudicles before they come home and realize they got
Yeah, sick? I think it's all at one time.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like they replace them.
Oh, nothing happened.
Right. The dog's like, hey, feels a little weird, but
nothing some licking can't fix.
Right, exactly. And quite honestly, I'm not as interested in the girls as I used to be, but fine.
I'll stick with the pillows. Yeah. I don't need an actual dog.
They're interested in him, though. Apparently.
And let's not forget, my owner looks really happy because it's all about him. Not
that's
the dog.
Hey, very proud. Take a look at it.
I don't know. Are you a dog whisperer, Ro? Do you talk to a lot of dogs?
I do actually talk to dogs. I know exactly. I got molested by a dog over the weekend.
What?
This is a true story.
Nudicles?
I was at a friend's house, and he has a 160-pound. I don't even know what this is. It's a very rare. They're like Newfies, but they're bigger, and they're hairier. It looks like a bear. It does not look like a dog.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
And
you're not
going to
fight. Just let it happen with one of those things.
Yeah, it's from Norway. They're Norwegian something or another. And this thing, you know, it took a liking to me. I've met it before, but it was like there was like a party and there were a bunch of people there, and this dog just started, and the dog would like come up and saddle up next to me. You know, there's a lot of standing around.
You were tying your shoe, and the next thing you know,
oh my god! At one point, I felt the dog's paw, which is like a gorilla paw, go around my leg and start pulling on me, and then he was simulated humping he was doing the hook, and then he was just doing the thing with the what they do when they start to, and I'm like,
yeah, we do.
And
know.
They literally, the people are like, oh my god.
So were you trying to play it cool at first, like, no, that's not going on, and then all of a sudden it was too hard to actually not.
I was trying, right? I was like, oh, stop that. Mason was the dog. I was like, Mason, stop that.
You're like, oh, I don't like it at all. Keep going.
And then the owner's like, oh, Mason. Mason!
Well, that doesn't make him stop. Have you ever noticed that?
No.
That really doesn't make him stop.
It was not interesting.
Sort of peel him off you.
This was like for hours this was going on. This was not like a short-term situation.
Serial humper.
Hours? We sat down to dinner and he sat right next to me.
Oh.
And it's like the size of a gorilla, this dog. I mean, it's not like a little, you know.
Is it a Norwegian elkhound?
I don't know. It's gigantic.
All right.
At one point, I backed up.
The question we all want to know is, had it been neutered?
How do I know?
Got pretty close to it.
To be intimate.
It's
with
real
the dog.
Hairy there. I don't know. I could. I
did
was,
you get a phone number?
I didn't. I really didn't want to go check it out because I didn't want to encourage anything. You know what I mean? All right. So let's check in with Judy and find out what's going on in the WGN newsroom.
Blackhawks training camp kicks off Friday. So one of our favorite former Hawks, Adam Burrish, joins the Steve Cochran Show tomorrow morning at 8:20 to talk hockey, Hawks, and life.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thanks for introducing us to the Nudicles.
I'll be on that Steve Cochran show tomorrow, too, by the way.
Oh, let me see.
Thanks for mentioning that.
Awkward. I see that. You weren't on the official promo. Oh, yes, you are on the official promo list. You're going to be there at 9:40 with Steve tomorrow morning, so tune in for Rokan, right. 9:40.
And don't forget that the stories that matter, coming up with Judy Pylak in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Don't anybody worry about that, right?
Right.
All right. Now, let's talk to Steve Stone. We were just talking about the unspeakable injury to Jose Abreu. That was really something. I don't ever want to think about that ever again. Because New York Post is now reporting what it was. And Steve Stone being brought to us by Let Us Entertain You Restaurants.
I figured go to Summer House, seeing as summer's almost gone, so it's a good time to get there. And pretty nice. You can go to Oyster Bar when you're in the neighborhood or Stella Barra.
There you go.
Love
true.
That place.
It's really fun. It's,
it is. It makes it feel like summer,
California.
It is.
It's going on there. All right. Let us. Okay. Couple weeks left in the White Sox season.
Yep.
It is the end of rebuild year one, transition year build, rebuild year one. For the players who are in the clubhouse, what are these last couple weeks like?
Well, actually, this is the end of rebuild year two. And for the players in the clubhouse right now, there are certain guys that are playing really well. They don't want to see the year end because they're starting to play real well. I think for Adam Engel, for instance, I don't think he wants to see this year end because he's just figured it out offensively. And so although he's playing great defense, he always plays great defense, that's not a startling revelation. But what is the fact that he's starting to sting the baseball, and we all knew that he would be a very valuable member of this team if he could just hit the ball to the clip of anywhere from 245 to 255, if he could do that. And he's knocking at the door of 245 as we speak. So for him, he probably wants a little bit more this year. For a lot of the guys, they're trying to put this year behind them, guys who have been injured or guys who are having tough years. They just assume this end and get on to their winter programs and get ready for next season, as they all realize that the competition was very strong this spring. It's going to be a lot stronger next spring as some of the younger guys start to stake a claim for positions. And so I think that we're seeing with an organization that is just developing right in front of our eyes, we're seeing the competition's going to get pretty stiff for starting jobs. So I think a lot of those guys are they're ready to see this year end and start getting on to on their programs, and then worry about where they're going to play next year.
Steve, what's an off season like for a modern day baseball player these days? Take a couple of weeks. What's the training regimen for a lot of these guys compared to maybe what it was 20 years ago?
I think they take a couple of weeks off, and I think they go right back to it. And not you know, not being a player of this era, I can only speculate. I know that these guys work very hard. I know they're 12-month-a-year athletes. It's completely different than it used to be. It used to be that you played as hard as you could. You worked out as hard as you could for 6 months, maybe 7 months, including spring training. And then you just took it easy, and you waited to regroup and let your body heal, but you didn't go on these intensive weight training programs or work out in the wintertime. But every player is given a set of instructions by their organization, and it comes from the training staff and the strength and conditioning staff, and it gives them an idea of what they want them to work on this winter and how they want them to do it and what program they want them on. And it takes into consideration just about everything that you could think of. And it's pretty comprehensive. So when these guys get to spring training, gone are the days when you came to spring training and rounded into shape, because if you do that now, you're not going to have a job, because you're going to find five guys that come to spring training are ready to go. So these guys are not taking a whole lot of time off. They're going right back at it, getting themselves in the best shape they possibly can, because they know the type of competition that awaits them in spring training from every ball club, but especially a rebuilding team like the White Sox, who have just a group of young players ready to go to burst on the scene.
And also these management camps that they go to, where literally the you know, agents and managers, you know, put together, they have these gigantic facilities for all the sports, and these guys, they go and they work out with professional trainers, and they do, you know, they cleanse and they juice and they do whatever. When I say juice, I mean juice like, you know,
right,
with the green drink and stuff like that. I mean, they do all these crazy things.
Yes, with blenders.
Yes, exactly. Not
and kale.
Blenders.
Yes, lots of kale.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, tremendous kale. You can't get enough kale. That's,
no, you can't.
That's one of my mantras.
As an athlete.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you, Steve. I know I stepped into it right there. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Appreciate it. We'll talk to you.
Have a good rest of the show.
Thank you. Have a good call tonight. All right, let's check in now with Judy Pilek, standing by. She's got WGN, isn't it? Concho with Anna DeVlantis right here on 720 WGN.
We're learning so much on the show today. It's been very educational.
Yes, and you're about to learn more. Coming up, your chance to win a pair of tickets to go see Legally Blonde, the musical. The high fashion kickoff to Paramount Theater's Broadway season. Playing now through October 21st. Get tickets at ParamountAurora.com or call the box office at 630-896-6666. All right.
That's nice.
That's right. All right, now it is time, and strap yourself in, because this will make you laugh, it'll make you cry, it'll make you wonder what in the hell is going on.
It's the top five on the Rokan Show.
Five.
Let's go.
Four, three, two, one.
Now, it's the top five at five on the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis. Sponsored by the Hip and Knee Center, where they help you feel new again.
Ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Get on with it.
Number five.
Now, the National Weather Service has upgraded the hurricane warning for Florence to a Category 4 catastrophic damage warning for all of the North Carolina, South Carolina, and part of the Virginia coasts.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
That's
serious.
That's what has happened. They say that when this thing comes on shore, it is likely to have 130-mile-an-hour sustained winds. And as you heard Tom Skilling say, there could be 50-foot waves associated with it. 50. There might be a 90-foot rogue wave out at sea.
Yeah. And he said it doesn't end when it makes it landfall, that there could be a major flooding event quite a ways inland and even areas that have not flooded before with this intensity and size of a storm.
So they have told 1 million people to get out. But there is always one yahoo.
We're going to ride it out, and I've lived here all my life, and I've never, you know, gone through a hurricane. And today, like you said, today was my first day buying a generator this morning at Lowe's. My wife, she went to Bed Bath & Beyond, and she bought a fan, you know, a box fan. We got five cases of water. We've got chips, all the canned necessities, batteries, flashlights, We got to make sure our little pets got plenty of food and prescriptions, you know, all that good stuff. So we basically got everything we need, 4 bags of ice, and we're just going to wait it out right now just for a few minutes. I mean, for a couple of days and see how it goes.
Because that's all you need? 4 bags of ice and some pet food? Boy, I would not mess around with this.
Well, you know, and here's the thing. At worst comes to worst, we can always eat the pets. Don't get too, tell the kids, don't get too attached to them. How stupid are these people? I mean, this is a guy who's never been through one before.
So he thinks it's like an event, like he's going to a show or something, a rock concert or something. I mean, come on, people. I'd say listen to your local authorities. I still come back to that Rockport, Texas mayor who said, if you don't want to evacuate and you're in a mandatory evacuation zone, write your social security number on your arm in permanent ink so we can identify you later. It's that serious.
Yes. 3,000 people died over time in Puerto Rico, they believe. 3,000 people. And hundreds when the hurricane hit. Now, there was not much. There was. It's an island. There weren't many places to go. Right? They couldn't get everybody off the island. Mm-hmm. I understand that. This is, and it's all politicized, but let's just deal with the realities of this. Katrina. Right? We don't even know the number at Katrina. It's anywhere from 1,000 to 3,000.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this is it. People who have lived through this are leaving. The people who are staying behind are first responders and people who are trained in what to do. This yahoo isn't trained in what to do.
No, and it's getting to the point where you need to leave very soon. The National Hurricane Center is saying the earliest they could start seeing tropical storm force winds is tomorrow night, most likely Thursday morning. But you don't have much time to get your stuff and get out of there.
What if you're one of the pets right now? You're in the pet. You're like, oh, no, dude. No.
Because they know before you know.
I don't need food and medicine. I need to get out.
These pets are freaking out.
I mean, I know these nudicles are lovely, but you got to start thinking here, goober.
If I stay, I'm getting fresh nudicles. The expensive ones.
You might need more than that.
Oh, no. We can just do it. I never done it before, but I believe I can breathe in water like Aquaman. Shut up. All right, checking in at
number 4.
Donald Trump Jr. was on Good Morning America, and he was asked, are you concerned that maybe you might have to go to jail?
Your father has denied reports that he's worried that you might be in legal jeopardy because of the Mueller investigation. But are you scared that you could go to jail?
I'm not, because I know what I did, and I'm not worried about any of that. You know, that doesn't mean they won't try to create something. I mean, we've seen that happen with everything. But, you know, again, I'm not.
Boy, that apple's not far falling far from the tree.
Yeah.
They've done that with everything. They're out to get us all. What about the New York Times op-ed?
I imagine this is a very low-level person. It's pretty disgusting. That's pretty sad. Perhaps it's a disgruntled person who's been thrown out because they didn't deliver on what they were supposed to do.
What's the crime, though?
Listen, I think you're subverting the will of the people. I mean, to try to control the presidency while not the president, you have millions and millions of Americans who voted for this. I think there are people in there that he can trust. It's just, it's a much smaller group than I would like it to be.
Who do you trust?
Well, you know, I'll keep that to myself.
And they're not family?
Well, obviously, yeah, I'm talking outside of family. Okay. I think that one goes without saying.
It's interesting you said
that. I wouldn't be so sure about that Kushner guy.
I'll be honest with you. Very quietly.
Kushner's not the kind of guy that looks like he wants to spend any time in prison, even though daddy did.
What's interesting, he said disgruntled insider who's been thrown out because he wasn't doing what he was supposed to do, because apparently there are a lot of stories out today that the president is considering that Rob Porter is one of the chief leakers.
Okay.
Remember him?
Yes. Yeah. I think it was, yeah. But Rob Porter was also saying, hey, that was mischaracterized in that Bob Woodward book. It wasn't me.
What is he going to say?
And I never took a swing at anybody either. Do you know Hope? Could you have her call me?
Anybody?
All right. And then finally, is he worried about impeachment?
So our people, the MAGA people, they have to turn up. They have to get out and vote. And I think we can break history.
President Trump has said that if voters don't go out and vote Republican, that it would lead to his impeachment, that they're basically letting him be impeached. Do you agree with that?
I think without question, because, you know, the reality is the Democrats play by different rules than the Republicans do.
let you know what the new what are the Trump rules? That's what I want to know. I want to take the Republicans and Democrats out of this because they seem to be their own kind of arbiter of what works and what doesn't.
Yeah.
All right. Is there one more? Is there anything else that I need to know here? Not in the script?
But some say that Mueller has been successful. He's has an indictment of Manafort. He has a plea deal from Cohen. He has Papadopoulos sentenced. You know, he's got a litany of close associates of your father's under investigation.
All and, for things and some that happened way before they were ever part of any campaign. So if they get Manafort on a 2006 tax charge, you know, again, I understand that they are trying to get my father, and they'll do anything they can to get that.
Yeah, but why did... plead ignorance here, but why did he answer the question, why did he have that meeting?
No.
With the Russians?
Well, remember, he was kind of all over the board with his reasons for it. Changed from adoptions to something else.
Yes.
And then as soon as he realized what it was about, he walked out. It was a nothing meeting.
Yes, but he received an email that told him what he was going to get, and when he didn't get it, he walked out. There was an email. An email, his own words on an email to explain right. that they got dirt, right?
Seemed excited about it in that email.
Yeah.
Exchange.
All right. Okay. I don't. Okay. I told myself I was not going to get excited about this. I'm going to continue. This is a very solemn day in America. I'm not going to go down this road. All right. Speaking of that, we actually do have the president in a moment of great solemnity today. And we'll play that for you coming up in the... remaining 3, 2, and 1 of the top 5 at 5. Judy, what's coming up in the newsroom?
A possible shooting on I-57 in Chicago.
WGN traffic being brought to you by TSA PreCheck.
Tonight, the fight for the Central Division's at Wrigley. Bring it, Milwaukee. Cubs Brewers tonight at 7 on WGN-TV.
Bring it!
Bring it!
Top 5 of 5 continues right here up to...
number 3.
All right, Gayle King did a little upset this morning on the CBS Morning Show.
She's in an awkward position. Think about that.
Because you got the outgoing CEO of CBS, Les Moonves, calling... She was calling for transparency from the network because he's been fired, and there have been a handful of women that have accused him over... There were 6 in the original... accusations, and then the New Yorker released another. Ronan Farrow had another article with 6 more. And that's when CBS decided to move on. Some of these, though, date back to the 1980s when he wasn't at CBS. The places he was at Lorimar or at Warner Brothers, places he had been, you know, but they seem to be fitting a pattern here. Mm-hmm. Of having sex with people who he's working with. In some cases, it was consensual, then turned non-consensual. And then in other cases, which is a tricky business. But then in other cases, it was like, hey, you know, this is what I need for us to get this deal done. So here is Gayle King.
Women don't come out and speak this way for no reason. They just don't. They just don't do it. And so I don't know how we move forward if we don't, we at CBS don't have full transparency about what we find. In our own house, we must have transparency. And I certainly feel for Julie Chen today. You know, she's in a very difficult position. And, you know, Les Moonves has done some wonderful things for this company. Mm-hmm. And we can't forget that either. So it's just a bad situation all the way around. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad that we are covering the story. And it's important that we cover it and get to the bottom of wherever, whatever it is.
Yeah, that Julie Chen thing always... sort of rub me the wrong way.
Why? Because she's a former host that he married?
He married her, and she got every job on the network.
She was Big Brother host and things like that.
Right.
Look,
I mean, they'd been dating for a while, then they got married, and she literally had 3 jobs at CBS. Was she really the best talent CBS has? She became the face of the network.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're a woman at CBS, do you feel like that's fair?
Probably not. No, I think for Gayle, it's so tough at this moment because think about it. She just saw her trusted, revered co-host, Charlie Rose, depart the network under those types of charges. And now the head of CBS. And what they're saying here is that just like an out of what NBC did, they handle these things in-house in these secretive investigations, and they don't really let everyone know. Like NBC did an in-house sexual harassment investigation about Matt Lauer and who knew what when, and then determined, well, the bosses really didn't know and Matt Lauer's gone, so it's all fine and everything's good now. And I think what she's saying is this transparency and the results of that investigation should be known. We shouldn't hide these things if you want to feel there's integrity moving forward. That's a tough position to be in, talking about your boss, your big boss, and having done.
Well, you're no longer your boss.
Yeah.
Will he end up back in show business? It's a little unclear.
Will he get his $150 million payout, which is still on the table potentially? If they find, you know, he resigned, and so he's still going for that, and there's a lawsuit likely to be filed.
Yeah.
Which is always interesting, too, when you sort of get a golden parachute when you disappear under these circumstances.
It's interesting. One of the things in there that fascinated me in that story was that he had had a consensual relationship with this woman at a different company, and then she comes to have a meeting with him at his current company, and they hadn't been together in a long time, mm-hmm. and he just starts trying to make out with her. You know, like pick up where they left off.
Just all of a sudden.
Yeah, and she's like, no, that was then, this is now. And got all upset about it. And it's one of those moments where, I mean, this is at least if you believe the New Yorker report, this is a guy who liked to take his pants off every time there was a woman in the office. It's sort of a Lauer-esque kind of a thing that was going on there.
Yeah. If you really read the details, they are worse than it was originally reported.
All right. And checking in now.
Number two.
All right. Now, Heidi Klum, she was on the Ellen DeGeneres show, and she played Who'd You Rather with Ellen DeGeneres, and her answer to every time she was asked, it was always Drake. She's got a thing for Drake. So Drake calls her.
Oh.
And says, hey, what's up?
I didn't even have his number. He didn't have my number.
How'd he find you?
Because someone who I know knows him, and I guess he asked to have my number, and then he texted me, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is so weird. But then I never texted him back because I found the love of my life.
Wait, he texted you and you didn't even respond? All right, well, but still.
I'm embarrassed about it.
Yeah, well, you need to text him back and say, sorry,
Drake, I'm sorry I didn't text you back.
Yeah.
Be cool.
Yeah.
I still love your music.
Yeah.
I still love your music. I'll probably come to the concert. It's very soon.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're not going to be able to get in.
No, I'm fine.
How'd you like to be the dude that she's the love of her life now? Right?
Do you tell that story? I don't, is Drake okay with it? I guess he doesn't care.
Yeah. Drake's going to be just fine.
But if you don't text somebody back, I don't know.
Maybe she's
Kiki.
You don't
tell that story, I don't think. She's what?
Kiki, the Kiki challenge. Kiki, do you love me?
Yep. I don't think. I just want to. If she is, again, I'm just going back to whoever the love of her life is right now.
He's probably like,
it's sort of
what?
Like, hey, wait a second. Hey.
No, he's got to know she's got options.
Well, wasn't she? She was with David Copperfield, right? She's the one that was. Who was the one that was?
She was with
Well, Seal was her husband.
Seal.
She had children with Seal.
Right. And she's no longer with Seal, right?
She was with a race car driver, remember?
Is she old enough to be Drake's mom? I mean, that's the other thing.
She could be.
Oh, Mrs. Stifler.
But that's...
Stifler's mom. All right. And finally...
Number one.
President Trump today in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, paid a solemn tribute to the 40 passengers and crew members on board Flight 93.
Earlier this week, you dedicated the final part of this memorial, the Tower of Voices. Standing at 93 feet tall, the Tower of Voices is now the first structure visitors see when they come to this now sacred ground. It will hold 40 beautiful chimes that ring throughout these fields, each a unique note, but all in perfect harmony. Each time we hear those chimes playing in the wind, we will remember the 40. We will remember their faces, their voices, their stories, their courage, and their love. And we will remember that free people are never at the mercy of evil, because our destiny is always in our hands.
The Top 5 at 5.
Rokan Show with Anna DeBlantis right here on 720 WGN. It's a solemn day in America, September 11th. And I read a story this week about Al-Qaeda, because we've forgotten about Al-Qaeda. We don't talk about international terrorism so much anymore. The threats that the politicians like to talk about are domestic, right? Whether it's political parties or Mexicans or whatever it happens to be.
Right.
And we've stopped talking about that. And I thought this would be a good moment to talk to Bob Baer, one of the most decorated, if not the most decorated, publicly acknowledged CIA officer in the history of that agency. And Bob, is Al-Qaeda still alive and well?
Oh, I think it absolutely is. I think you're going to see that it's regrouped in the wake of what's happened in Syria and Iraq. With Iraq now moving back to chaos, you're going to see this sort of reordering of the Sunni community there, and they're going to turn to violence. I think what we're seeing, the reason we don't notice it is because the worst sides of Al-Qaeda, you know, the attacks in Istanbul and Paris and the rest of it, have just sort of gone away thanks to policing and thanks to people just deciding that it's not going to do them any good to kill, you know, kill tourists in France. No, it's not going to go away. Zawahiri is still there. He's hiding in Pakistan. There's this belief that violence is the only way that's going to save the Sunni majority in the Middle East.
And people should realize that ISIS and Al-Qaeda are different things, and Al-Shabaab, there's a number of these different organizations. And one of the pieces in this article that I thought was fascinating is that Al-Qaeda has changed, as you're pointing to, has changed its tactics. They no longer want to spend time and money developing people that they are going to sacrifice, that they're going to kill in their own actions, like they did on September 11th. They want it. They if they're going to spend time and money training people, they want those people to be able to survive the incident. Is that what your friends still in the business are telling you?
Well, we don't see as many suicide attacks except in Afghanistan, and that's sort of a one-off. But you just have to see that it's become more pragmatic, Al-Qaeda. Clearly, running airplanes into American buildings and killing 3,000 civilians it got them nothing. They're a lot worse off for it. Or even the Islamic State beheading journalists, it got them nothing. It was completely counterproductive for them, and I think you're seeing a more mature organization that's going to defend the community and use Islam as a basis for it. But they haven't gone away. They've just sort of gone underground. And they're going to wait to see what happens in Syria and Iraq. And it's almost guaranteed they're going to come back.
Is America today safer or less safe than it was on September 10th of 2001?
I think we're a lot safer. You've had, you know, software has been developed to detect people, radicalization. A lot of these people are being rolled up very quickly. You know, we've given up certain liberties, but I think we're definitely safer. And I think we saw two attacks in the United States, San Bernardino and Florida, Orlando. But it's fairly minor. And this fear that we had the enemy within in this country, it just turned out not to be true. And I think, you know, everybody's just sort of caught on that this has been absolutely a total disaster, 9/11, for us, for our politics, for the Middle East. and things are not better. So the whole idea that terror, you know, idealization of violence is going to get you anything has just disappeared.
Now, as you look at the political landscape here, do you think that the priorities at the Pentagon level are the right priorities for this?
I think, you know, frankly, I think it's almost, and I've had people at the Pentagon say this to me, that we won the battle on terror with Flight 93 when we figured out to take weapons away from these people. It was almost simultaneous, but now we're fighting on way too many fronts. We don't even know what the battle is about in Niger or Mali or the rest of it. It's just sort of an insurgency which we got caught in, and we can put drones up forever, but we're not going to kill an idea with it. We're overextended, and we're losing political influence. Matt, when you got Russian troops defending our main ally in the Middle East, Israel, that's a sea change.
Do you think, it's interesting you mentioned that, because there was some talk earlier, it was late last week, that the Russians were warning U.S. forces in Syria, ground forces that are in Syria, special operators, that they needed to get out of a base that they were near because they were going to attack that base, because that base that had the anti-Assad partisans were attacking the Russians and the Assad forces. And so it's a weird situation that we're being told by the Russians and by the Assad people, hey, get out of the way here because we're coming after the guys that you're basing up with.
It's everything's upside down. The Russians haven't taken and occupied land militarily since 1946. This is the first time. You know, I'm looking at this as almost as the Cold War 2.0, and I guarantee you the way they've split this country apart on this Russian saga, they're winning. Or these far-right parties, Austria and Italy and Hungary, you know, allied with Russia. I mean, it's amazing, this change, we walked away in 91 patting ourselves on the back. Look, we won the Cold War, all done. Russia's a second-rate power. We have to be tolerant of them. And they've just come back. And they're still a second-rate nation, but they've managed to divide us like we've never been divided during the real Cold War, the old Cold War.
You look at 9/11, Bob, and which began the U.S.-led invasion into Afghanistan, and here we are nearly 17 years later. Initially, they talked about the idea was to capture Osama bin Laden, to break apart al-Qaeda, and then the focus became fighting the Taliban. And what now? What do you see as the future of troops in Afghanistan and what the U.S. goals actually are there?
Well, it's not winnable because we were fighting a Pashtun tribal confederation. And now, in fact, today, they're talking in the White House about privatizing the war, turning to Eric Prince and Frontier Services and seeing if he can do a better job, simply because we're losing ground there. We continue to. You can't take a minority like the Tajiks and fight the Pashtuns indefinitely. And these people just don't give up. It really is the graveyard of empires. And we're going to have to find a different way to do this. And I think the Russians, by the way, it's pretty evident that they are supporting the Taliban with weapons and money.
Yeah, well, turn around, right? I mean, this is you just want to look at how this, you know, when they were there, we were supporting them, right? Charlie Wilson's war. Mm-hmm. And now it's, you know, it's clear that this game of international ping pong for 100 years continues. It's interesting that you mentioned privatization. Now, Eric Prince, of course, that's Blackwater. That's Betsy DeVos's brother, right? He's very politically connected. The other countries, we would call them mercenaries here. We call them contractors. But these contractors have been playing a role since the beginning, since 2001, haven't they? And what is your, as a professional CIA, former CIA operative guy who's on the ground in these countries working for the United States of America, not for a private company, what is your thought on that?
You have to look at history. It's never gone well. Blackwater didn't do too well in Iraq when they shut up those civilians, and five guys were indicted.
You know, it's tough to run these groups, but on the other hand, militarily, we are failing in Afghanistan. And we have really since the beginning. I mean, let's face it, the people who protected Osama bin Laden in October 2001 was the government of Pakistan. There's just no doubt about it. He went to Abbottabad, was put in a house in a military garrison, and that's our main ally. And these are the guys that we depend upon to supply our troops. The Pakistanis are completely unreliable. We've been paying them billions of dollars. And I, you know, share very few sentiments with this president, but one is just total frustration about the Pakistanis. Yeah. And so if we don't have allies on the ground, and even in the war in Iraq, our main ally was effectively Iran. So it's a situation that's so schizophrenic, you really don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah. We will leave it there, but Bob, thank you so much. I know this is a solemn day for everybody.
Thanks.
Especially for all of your folks who, you know, the first person to die in the war on terror in the fall of 2001 was a CIA operative, not
Mike Spann.
Right. And it should be remembered that those are the first guys on the ground there. So thank you for your service to the country, sir. Appreciate it, as always.
Thank you.
Bob Baer. All right, let's check in with Judy Pilak. What's coming up in the news at the top of the hour?
A crisis that could last a very long time.
Traffic being brought to you by the Illinois Department of Transportation. Show with Anna DeBlantis live from the Allstate Skyline Studios in Chicago, downtown Chicago, on WGN Radio.
Strange, the calm weather that Tom Skilling just described that we're having as a result of the ferocious storm that's heading to the East Coast, the hurricane.
It's one of the things that you definitely want to sell as a Chicago moment. People are like, it's so cold. So cold.
Can't complain about the weather right now. You're not allowed to.
I've been showing some people around Chicago who are moving here from other places.
What's their impression?
Around the
they
globe.
Liking it?
And it's interesting. They do. They do. But they're like, oh, it's going to be so cold. And I'm like, ah, you wait. It's really, you know, global warming. Been very good to us. Very good to us. It's not like it was in the 70s when it was, you know.
It barely snows here anymore.
Yeah, well, it kind of barely does by comparison. Used to, would start snowing in December, and you would never be able to not climb over an ice snow mound that looked like coal because there was so much grease and oil and stuff on it until April.
That's true.
I mean,
it would take forever to melt.
Right. You now have circumstances where, you know, we may have one or two bad snowstorms a year.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes away after a couple of weeks, sometimes a couple of days.
I know. It's been a couple of years since we've had a white Christmas. What is that?
I know.
I think we had one like 2 years ago.
Thank you for saying Christmas, by the way.
There's a war on it.
I know the war is on.
Yeah. All right. Hey, listen to this. Science has found Princeton University scientists, not just any kind of scientist.
No.
Princeton.
The real deal.
Yeah. I think didn't Princeton just make it number one again in private institutions in the U.S. News World Report?
They're always
best
there.
Colleges.
Yeah.
You know who made it for public universities?
Hmm.
It'd be a shocker. UCLA. How about that?
I always thought they were smart.
Yeah, they're very smart. That's not why I called. Here's why I called.
Okay.
Science says that within 3 seconds of meeting somebody, you learn 9 things immediately about them. You make 9 decisions about them.
Yes, I love this.
Within first meeting them. 1, are they trustworthy?
Oh, that in 3 seconds.
A tenth of a second to decide trustworthiness. 1/10 of a second.
Well, not if they're trustworthy, if you trust them, right?
Right. Okay. It took 100 milliseconds to rate attractiveness, competence, likability, aggressiveness, and trustworthiness.
all that.
I think that's just true.
100 milliseconds, 1/10 of a second to figure that out.
You can tell right away, you know?
I was going to say, it's even shorter for...
For what, women?
Yeah.
Well, there's either an instant thing where you're like, ah.
Definitely attractiveness. I think everybody immediately knows if they're attracted to somebody or not. Sure.
Trustworthiness, though?
Trustworthiness. Yeah, that seems like a bit of a stretch.
Within a few seconds, I think that...
Yep.
I'm not sure.
Likeability and attractiveness, definitely. I think you can get that vibe right away.
I wonder if that's
and aggressiveness.
Competence? How do you know competence within... I think you have to wait for somebody to open their mouth to figure out if they're competent. Because somebody could look really great, and the next thing I was like, well, now we're going to stay behind when the hurricane showed up.
You've got some ice and a
that
cooler.
That guy might be a star at his work, and then all of a sudden, like, wait, Fred's staying behind? That guy's an idiot.
I always go by the handshake.
But that doesn't always tell you something, does it?
It's a pretty good indicator.
I hate girls that give you the claw. I'm like, God.
Or the woman with the weak handshake, too. We do have
that.
Or
the one with the really strong handshake that
overly strong
squeezes, your hand to
death. That's never good.
You could tell within the first second if somebody is high status or not even based on their clothing.
What?
You think if you're just clothing, how somebody does that, maybe that would be the deal.
So how do you decide?
The way they talk?
Apparently, it has to... It's an instinct within a second. Hmm. Of meeting somebody, what their status is. It's got to be based on grooming.
Yeah, I was going to say,
assuming.
Teeth. That's what my mom always said. Teeth, keep them good. Don't look like all like you just rolled out of bed and you lost your toothbrush for a month.
I think you'll seem important if you wear sunglasses indoors.
I think people have a lot of opinions about that.
I always heard shoes. You look at someone's shoes. They've got the fancy shoes that are expensive.
Did Forrest Gump say that?
Maybe.
I think he did.
Did he?
Not
but I agree. Somebody's got like their shoes untied or they're all dirty.
I don't think it's anything you're wearing. I think it's how you hold yourself.
Yeah.
Oh, God, if you're holding yourself, that's a whole other situation.
Well.
all right. You can tell.
I find that very likable.
People can read a man's sexual orientation within a 20th of a second.
I'm so bad at this.
Me too.
I have a bad radar for that.
It's the same amount of time it takes to recognize a face.
Really?
20th of a second. This is Princeton. This is not me talking.
I've gotten caught by that.
Well, because
everyone admits that.
Right, wait, hold on. Yeah, explain that.
Well,
what do you mean you've been caught by that?
I was in Greece with a girlfriend, and we were having like the best time ever. We went to this, the hotel guy, you know, the concierge type, told us to go to this great restaurant. It was like the best place. And we went there, and the guys were so good looking. We were single, and we thought this was awesome. We're like, oh my gosh, these guys are so good looking. Didn't realize. Did not realize for hours. Hours. And then we went to another place after a nightclub, and then we realized because it was a gay nightclub they took us to. I'm like, this is not what we
expected. See, for me, it happens the other way. I'm like, I thought, wait, what? I thought you were gay. I thought you were just being nice.
That must be really the greatest moment for these guys, too. They were like, hey, how you doing? I thought you were gay. I don't know.
We were talking about that guy.
I would like to know what the trigger point in that is. I thought they were gay.
Well, it's not necessarily when they're lighting the candles, because you're like, okay, gay people like candles, I think. And then...
What do you mean lighting the candles?
I don't... Just lighting candles. And...
someone lights a candle?
Then they're gay?
No, but I was... You know...
That's code for something. Is that code for something?
No, if you're with someone, like, you wouldn't question them lighting the candles, because...
Where do you live? We have electricity here. What year is this? Are we on the radio?
Wait a minute.
It's the radio. No,
how many years ago is this?
There's certain things where the romantic part, you don't notice it until after. You know, like, they were lighting candles to be romantic, but I thought they were lighting candles because they like the smell of, you know, vanilla.
And then you thought that made him gay?
No, they...
I am definitely not picking up on this. Please explain.
When you're hanging out with someone.
Okay.
Just two
like
people.
Like where? Like in someone's home?
At a home.
Yeah. Is it your home or their home?
Their home.
Okay, their home.
Right. And, you know, they're like, oh, I'm just going to light some candles.
Uh-huh.
And so you don't think that's romantic because you're thinking this person's gay. So that's why you're hanging out with them. And then there's a turning point in the night when you're like, whoa.
Dude, you're gay.
Yeah, what are you doing?
Wow, it's right.
Never mind.
A British study found that women with visible tattoos were perceived to be less attractive, heavier drinkers, and more promiscuous than females without tattoos.
Huh.
I can see that. Certain people are judgy about tattoos.
Yeah.
Some guys love girls with tattoos.
Yeah.
They're mm-hmm. like, oh, dude, it's all I'm going for. Yeah. Some guys, complete opposite.
Yeah, but it's like one tattoo on your hip bone, right, cool.
Right, is it a sleeve on the left arm, or is it like a tattoo that's hidden somewhere?
Right.
That's the difference.
Right.
If you have a sleeve, that's a personality lifestyle choice.
Yeah, clearly.
You're like middle finger to everybody. Like, I don't care, I'm doing whatever I want.
Yeah.
Some guys love that.
Right.
Yeah.
Some girls love that.
In Britain, they have a term, ladette. Like lad, like mm-hmm. lad, like dudes,
like the lads.
Yeah, those are guys who are out on the make, and then the ladettes are the ones who are out on the make too. It's like promiscuous women. Yeah, I know. I'm like my grandfather now.
Oh, promiscuous.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
What else did the study say?
The study also says that bald is powerful. This is actually a University of Pennsylvania study found that. Bald men are perceived to be more powerful than fully haired men.
Really?
Yeah.
It all depends how they rock it.
Yeah, I think a good head of hair or a bald head, if you commit completely to both.
To the bald.
Yeah.
And it's not like the first day they committed and it's like completely white on top. Like they've got it's been exposed to some sun. Like this guy's a veteran in the bald game.
Yeah. So guys are like shining it and tanning it and doing all that sort of stuff. What about a bald guy with a neck tattoo that goes up into the back of the cranium? How do we feel about that one?
Bye-bye.
Or face tattoos in general. I think people get judged a lot for those.
I mean, that is definitely a
That's
statement.
A commitment.
It's generally a prison tat, is the way I look
well,
at it.
Well, not anymore. You've got, I have some pretty elaborate face tattoos.
At, like, Linkin Park Zoo or, like, a real tattoo? Face painted
ones.
In 2011, a Canadian study showed that female students can, just by photos alone, tell whether someone is going to be successful. Going to be successful.
And then they later proved in the study that they were successful.
Well, they were looking at photos, you know, like before and afters. And the befores, befores, women were very likely to be able to figure out whether or not a person was going to end up being rich.
That's wild.
That's interesting.
That is.
It's interesting that they asked them that, too. It's so funny that, you know, that came up.
Well, it's because you got to know what you're getting yourself into.
Whatever happened to love?
Don't people marry for that anymore?
Did they ever marry for that?
All right, guys.
You're
just
being so cynical. You're still young.
Line up, and only straight men need apply, and don't be lighting candles near her.
Yeah, really. No judging there.
Six figures minimum.
Right. Six figures.
The rest of you bums can get out of here.
Right. We don't need fancy dandy candle lighters.
But you're pursuing a dream, but you don't make get out of here.
Yeah. Be a man. Either be fully bald and committed to it or have nice hair. Either way.
What kind of man likes vanilla anyway?
Yeah.
This guy's a wuss. He likes candles.
Do you like the vanilla scent? Because I love the vanilla scent.
I thought you invited me to here to smell candles with you.
Yes, I am just totally. I'm hanging out with you because I feel totally safe here.
You want to go to Yankee Candle later? We'll smell all the candles.
Want to help me pick out clothes?
I'm really.
Oh, bad. Mr. Weinstein, I thought for sure you were gay.
Yes. What is going on here? What am I getting in the hot tub with you?
Mr. Moonbat.
What do you mean, watch you in the shower? What does that mean?
That's not really what guy girls do unless they're interested.
Well, you're going to light candles before you get naked, right? And then everything's fine?
And I'm going to light some candles and I'm going to get in the shower.
And then you can come watch. It'll be fine. Because,
Okay, I guess. I guess you're gay. It's okay, I guess.
I'm really bad at that.
I need to get candles.
Yes, you are very
bad.
Maybe
this will work.
Yeah,
this
is really something.
I got candles.
I had no idea. All right. There we go. I think we've answered all the life's problems
Thankfully.
Right there. There you go.
I'm glad we can judge people so quickly.
Science proved that we're a very judgy sort. All right. I got to get out of this. Judy, what do you have coming up at the bottom of the hour in the newsroom?
And I'm always the scapegoat.
Could some high-profile Latino leaders be entering the race for mayor of Chicago?
Are those two related? I couldn't tell.
I know. I didn't know which one was the T.
Yes, you can read that either way.
All right. All right. Tomorrow on the program, the iPhone is coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And we will have Andy Iannatko explain to us what the new iPhones are going to be doing. And if you're like a, not an iPhone person, but you're an Android person, you're like, I don't care. I just don't care. So, I have a better camera than you.
That's probably true. The new iPhone is going to be the most expensive ever made. And I thought the 10 was pretty pricey, so we'll have to see what you get for all the extra bucks.
And it's supposed to be much bigger.
And the home button is definitely gone now. This is the first year they're not going to have a home button on any of their phones.
I hate people that have the new phones. I still don't know. I'm like, can you open this? How do I take a picture? There's no buttons. I feel like I'm 100 when I pick up an iPhone 10.
Well, because it doesn't recognize you as its owner.
I know, but even if you put it in the other person's face, I just don't know how to close the apps. And
she
the
does that button. To all the bodies. Or when someone's asleep, she puts it up. Here, come on, open up, open up.
You have to hold their eyelids open.
Right, because it knows if they're asleep.
Yeah, it does.
That's the damnedest thing.
It totally is.
Right, it's got the whole thing figured out.
Remember that woman who woke up her husband on a plane and then started, or it took a got the facial recognition thing going and then searched the phone.
Yeah.
But now, yeah, they've made it more difficult to do that without the person knowing.
So that is good.
Well, that's just annoying for all girlfriends everywhere.
It really is. Apple, would you stop with the technology, please?
We need to know
it's messing
some things.
Life up.
How am I going to sneak through all of his texts? How am I supposed to do that?
The rule is if you feel you need to, you already know the answer.
Okay, Anna, thanks.
What? Is you're feeling that way?
So there's that. Tomorrow, this conversation will be continued tomorrow. We've got White Sox tickets. Some of your last chances to rip us off for White Sox tickets this season coming up tomorrow. So, one of your last chances, I should say. And then we've got other important stuff. I can't remember it right now, but I know it's good. Oh, we'll check in with the Bears headquarters, Bears HQ,
yeah,
with Adam Hogue.
Great.
No big deal.
See how the Nagy era is going.
Mm-hmm.
Better than the Chucky era did last night.
Yeah, new coaches, 0-7 in week one.
Yeah.
Worst start ever.
Yeah.
Matt Nagy amongst them. John Gruden saying some stuff about Khalil Mack today.
I just want to say
that. What did he say?
He's like, Khalil Mack clearly didn't want to be here. I'm like, okay.
So it's on
clearly
him?
You didn't want him to be there
right.
either.
You didn't return
you
his phone
used
calls.
Him last night when you lost by 20 points and couldn't get to the quarterback. They got no pass rush in Oakland.
The average age on the Oakland Raiders is 65 years old.
Weird.
There are players. I swear to God, I thought I said Sid Luckman on the sidelines warming up to come into the game. It was like, there are guys that I thought these guys have been out of the NFL for like 10 years. I don't know what it's all about. All right, all that's coming your way tomorrow on this very radio program. Right now on WGN 720 Chicago, White Sox Radio on the air.